You're listening to Bigfoot Live, starring Thomas Gardy, the world's most respected authority on the phenomena known as Bigfoot. Sit back and relax as we take you on a journey into the world of the unknown. Believer or skeptic, man or woman, you will be mesmerized by real people telling real descriptions about real encounters. Fasten your seatbelts, America. It's reality radio at its finest, and it starts now.
In 1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks in the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
There he is.
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out of the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees right now. Come here, look.
I'm Bob Hallmark, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television in Tyler, Longview. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight, and I have to admit that I was skeptical when I came out here. I thought we, at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, I convinced them I had to change my opinion on Bigfoot. I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
When I landed on the ground, I was kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
Out in the swamps, what you think I've seen? Something strange, you know. Sasquatch sitting on his thigh's knee, and he was talking to Moccasin Joe. Well, the party gonna have out in the St. John's Swamps. Sasquatch doing a brand new dance, and he called it the Bigfoot Stomp.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Marco Bill on the Bigfoot Live broadcast. And folks, it's that time of the week again. It's time for the Wednesday evening Bigfoot Live radio show with our host, Mr. Tom Biscardi. And now, everybody, the man who put the big back into Bigfoot, our host and renowned Bigfoot researcher, Mr. Tom Biscardi. Good evening, Tom. How are you tonight?
Hey, good buddy. I'm top draw, believe it or not. And you know, by listening to that little titty in the beginning about, you know, what got me into this crazy business was our main subject tonight. Okay. You heard me say there about that film in 1967, ladies and gentlemen, and friends around the world tonight, around the globe. That's the thing that got me interested, just like it did so many people in this world. I was one, just like you. I said to myself, my gosh, is there such a creature out there? Roaming these woods, roaming these hills, roaming these mountains around the United States of America and beyond. I was one of those people that took it serious because of this Roger Patterson film. That's what we're going to discuss tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We've titled it The Swindle Behind the Patterson-Gimlin Film Footage Deception. Think about that. The swindle behind the Patterson-Gimlin film footage deception. After tonight, we're going to leave it to you. We're going to let you come up with the decision after you hear the stories from pros and from people who've who've taken parts of their life to investigate this thing. I happen to be one. Our new movie, ladies and gentlemen, that's out there, Hoax of the Century. If you haven't seen it, you better go see it. Because I'm going to tell you right now, it answers a lot of the questions that are going to be asked this evening. The man that wrote the book, Mr. Greg Long, he's become a wonderful friend of mine. He's probably one of the straightest shooters you'll ever meet in your life. The Making of Bigfoot, that was his book. Never got his just a due. And I'll tell you the reason why. Because this is the holy grail, supposedly, of all the Bigfoot films. And I guess he puts it the best way ever. Nobody ever decided to go out and really challenge the person who took this footage and to find out who that person really was. We're going to go into depth tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and we're going to find out who Roger Patterson really was, for those of you who don't like to read, okay? This man, Greg Long, spent a lot of time, a lot of hours investigating a lot of people who were connected to this film. He knows a lot of the answers, as you'll hear as we continue on throughout the show. Another guest we have is a good old friend of mine, Mr. Ray Crow, from up there in Oregon. Ray's become a longtime favorite of mine. I used to love his pamphlet that he put out there every month. We were a proud donor each and every month to that. And he used a lot of our expeditions in his newsletter that he put out. And we were the ones that made it capable, him to have it put out each month, because we donated to it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not talking about just the content, but the financial matter donation to help him put it out so you people could read it. And I was very happy to do that. And he's become a great friend also. He's also realized the fact that, oh my God, after seeing our movie, after reading Greg Long's book, my gosh, the timeline is completely wrong, and these guys are right. And you're going to hear from him. You're also going to hear from a guy that we've had on the show many times, and I've grown to really adorn his work. He's something else. He's Leroy Blevins, ladies and gentlemen. If you see some of his stuff, we've got it, I think, on our website here tonight on BigfootLive.com. You need to take a look at it. It's going to blow your mind. The one that got me going on this whole thing was an email that I received the 22nd of October, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to read it to you. I'm going to just give you his first name. His first name is Richie. But he writes to me, Mr. Biscardi, while watching the Patterson footage, I noticed that 1 minute and 17 seconds in, a man steps from behind a tree that is just right center of the frame. He steps out and then back behind the tree in about 1 second. But he is there. If you pause the film, he should be almost right below the play arrow on the screen. Thank you for your time. Sincerely, such and such. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we knew this. We knew that there are multiple versions of this film out there. And our guy, Leroy Blevins, was one that caught it. And you'll see it. And after you see it, it'll make you think. And remember one thing. Film does not lie if you have the original that has not, it's been unedited. Without any further ado, we're going to go up to Oregon, ladies and gentlemen. Talk to my good friend. Bring him on the line, Mr. Ray Crow. Ray, how are you?
Hey, very good, Tom. I've been listening to your introductions. They sound like you're going to really have a great night tonight.
Well, we are. And I'll tell you what, a lot of it has to do with your research and your book that you're doing. And, Ray, do me a favor, because it's been so long. What was the name of that thing you did each month? Tracks? Something Tracks?
It was a track record.
A track record. There you go.
Huh?
Yeah. People around the United States and abroad, they used to wait each month for those pamphlets that you used to put out each month. Gosh, how long did that go for?
17 years I run that thing. It was 20 pages of news and articles and things of interest to Bigfooters.
Boy, I'll tell you. And every month they used to look for it, without a doubt. I'll never forget it. Now, here's the big question. When you first saw that Patterson-Gimlin film, what did you think? What came to mind?
Oh, well, I assumed at the time, just like everybody else, that it was a real creature. And it wasn't until sometime later when I started hearing things about the timeline and where the development was and film development was, and began to have my doubts then. But it wasn't until just rather recent, after rereading Greg Long's book again, that I finally come to the conclusion, well, hey, there's something terribly wrong here.
Okay. So I like where you paused or you stopped. What was the thing that you found out that was wrong, Ray?
Oh, well, I got into this timeline, and that was really confusing. First, you know, it was shot by at about 1:30 in the afternoon. Patterson told the Province BC News that in October 25th. And what it started out with is it was bang, the film is shot. And then it takes about 5 minutes, and he's follows Gimlin around 300 yards to a bend. To then the Roger calls him back. That was Gimlin. Another 15 minutes is burned up when they were retrieving his scared horses after chasing them up and down the road. Gimlin said in a Green interview in 1992, Roger wanted to catch his horse and get some more film in the camera. It took quite a while to catch the horse and catch the pack horse as well and tie them up. So I only gave that 15 minutes. It was probably quite a bit more. But anyways, another 25 minutes is burned up with Patterson reloading the camera under his poncho. And here again with the Green interview at 92. The horse he was riding was pretty big fellow, a 1,300 pounder, and he rode alongside the tracks with his new film in the camera, and Roger took pictures of how deep the horse's prints were in the soil compared to the creature's tracks. Then I got up on a stump, he says, which is approximately 3 or 4 feet tall, and anyway, I jumped off the high-heeled boot to close on the track as we could. Then we took pictures of that to illustrate the depth that my footprint went into the same dirt with a high-heeled cowboy boot. Anyway, that was another 25 minutes. Then another half hour when they rode 2 miles back to the truck at the camper to get plaster for the tracks. They probably left their pack horse at the time. And the Internet says a horse's average walk is about 3 or 4 miles per hour. And it can be as low as 2 miles per hour, like when they're towing a pack horse. Anyway, that was a half hour. Burned up another 40 minutes or 30 minutes riding back to the site again at 4 miles an hour. Tracks are filmed with a second reel, 40 minutes, followed the creature for 3.5 miles until it lost the tracks up in the pine needles, 200 feet up a hillside. Then they plastered the two tracks that we see in Argosy. 1968 issue. 30 minutes burned up with plaster pouring into the two tracks and allowed to set. The Internet says at room temperature it takes 20 to 30 minutes to harden. And then we take photos of Roger holding the tracks another 5 minutes. And Gimlin says by the time we got the tracks cast, it was getting late. And then Haugson interview, Gimlin says it was already getting dark when they left. And the Green interview in 92 said the area, in that area, the sun goes down at 3:30 to 4 o'clock in the ravine. Then a 20-minute ride back to the truck again, and John Green and Gimlin interview them. It was almost dark by the time we got back down to the truck and got the horses fed and tied up. Then by the time they got back all the way into town, he says, at Al Hogson's store. I will underline that. Gimlin is saying that. They went to the town to Al Hogson's store directly from the site. I imagine it was about 8:30 or 9 o'clock. Then we went over to the whatever that town he says was to mail the film up to Al D'Atley. So what do we have here? More inconsistencies? Anyway, they fed the horses and they stowed their saddles and gear. Probably burned up 20 minutes. Used up another 40 minutes to drive 20 miles down to Highway 96 on a primitive road, maybe at 25 miles an hour. I'll give you some more speeds here, but I'm going to take them out of MapQuest so that I'm a little more accurate on it. Anyway, Roger Patterson told Al Hogson, this is in the Bigfoot's blog, Roger told me they went over Bald Hills, over to Oreck, and then went down to Eureka. So that's 36 miles and burned up 99 minutes. And then from Eureka down to Eureka was 41 more miles. That took another 6 hours and 42 minutes total or so. Anyway, some of the alternatives are they could have drove from Wichita-Pick to Willow Creek and slowed down for Hoopoe when they went through it. And still just, they probably just went straight to see Al Hogson because the film was already in Yakima, mailed earlier. And they could have then drove 47 miles to Eureka and do their business. Actually, it's a quicker route than it would have been going by way of Oreck. So they airshipped it from Arcata, supposedly Eureka Airport. This one possibility. John Green says they drove to Arcata. Through all the other sources, say they went to Eureka. Anyway, they airshipped from Murray Field, supposedly. That's 3 miles east of downtown Eureka. And burned up another 57 minutes, drive back to Willow Creek to meet Al Hogson and Sil McCoy at 6 p.m. So after way more than 6 hours, almost 7 hours, there's no way they could make that in that time frame. So anyway, this has really burned me up about this film, and I really think it's somebody's pulling some wool over our eyes.
You know, it's an interesting theory that you have. I've heard an awful lot of different ones, and I don't know if you really know. That footage was never taken on the 22nd or 20th, whatever the date it was there, of October 1967. Did you know that?
Yeah, oh, definitely, uh-huh.
Oh, you did know that?
Yeah, oh, well, yes, uh-huh. Well, they had to have done it much earlier.
That's right. That's exactly right. It was much earlier. And I'll tell you what, in our film, you'll see a pilot's log from Canada that was hired. You saw the film, and it was hired by a couple of the guys that were in that movie and who were called out supposedly to be a part of it and authenticate, I'm sure. And we go to find out that a lot of these people were all involved in this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And it just blows my mind up. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand something here, okay? This is our theory. This is what we've come up with timelines, with eyewitnesses, with people that you'll see in our movie, The Hoax of the Century. And oh, by the way, since that movie has come out, ladies and gentlemen, I'm only going to tell you this. That there has been parts authenticated and stating that, hey, you guys are right on, and we really cannot come out and
get behind what you're doing right now, but maybe in the very near future, we'll come out and tell the truth. This happens to be parts of maybe family members of this whole thing, ever since the movie came out. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you that it was not taken in October of 1967. I'm also going to tell you that Greg Long was probably the only real investigative reporter who went back to Yakima, who went back to talk to Hieronymus, the man in the suit, went back to talk to Roger Patterson's widow, Patricia Patterson, went back to talk to Gimlin, went back to talk to all the other people involved and the neighbors and the people of the town. So we've heard thus far from my good buddy, Ray Crow, and he's well respected in the industry, ladies and gentlemen, as you know. But I'd like to bring in Greg Long at this point in time. Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Tom.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much for joining us. I know how other commitments that you've got and other appointments and what have you, but you've taken the time to join us in this conversation tonight. What do you say about what Ray just talked about on the timeline situation?
Well, I gave that some thought, but didn't dig into estimates of specific amounts of time per actions taken by Gimlin and Patterson. In other words, I knew generally from what I had read where Patterson and Gimlin had originally driven on to Bluff Creek, parked their truck, where they went, and that sort of thing. And I really want to commend Ray for going through this effort to really pin down through references and sources he's found in the Bigfoot Fields literature, either published accounts, articles, newspapers, that sort of thing, to piece together point by point where these two gentlemen would have been at each moment in the whole process and what's a good estimate of the time it would have taken them to perform those actions. You know, and that kind of thing is what police organizations do when crimes are committed. When there's a crime committed, and in this case, I really believe this was a crime, not on the level of, murder or a felonious crime of that sort, but it really is quite a criminal act in the respect that it's false and it's a fraud. Police organizations dig into, the primary witnesses of a claim, and they interrogate them in depth. When they have gathered sufficient information to go out and confirm or deny where they were vis-a-vis, for example, what's their alibi, they painstakingly piece together where those particular potential criminals were. And it's a process that takes a great deal of legwork and a laborious effort. And we ought to commend Ray for doing that. I think he's really pushed this this revelation of this film as being a fraud much further down the line. And I think it's great work that he's done.
I totally agree with you. I really do. Now let's just, for the people that don't know who you are and what you've done, why don't we back up for a second and tell them how you got into this crazy thing.
Well, I professionally, until I retired in 2010, was a technical editor and writer for a number of different technical companies. One of them I can name now, having retired from it, I'm sure there wouldn't be a problem there, was CH2M Hill, which is a very large engineering company, very well known in the United States. It has multiple offices all over the United States and other parts of the world. During this profession of doing editing and writing, I maintain an interest in claims of the paranormal and so on and so forth, simply because of my interest in something that was certainly strange and exotic and appeared to have some substance to it. And being that I live near Seattle and work near Seattle and was only 2.5 miles from Yakima, I was able to go over there and dig into Patterson's life. Who was he? Before I'd even moved up here, though, when I was a young man, just like you, Tom, I had heard about the film, was intrigued by it, but basically filed it away. It wasn't something that I was interested in looking into. But being here in the Northwest and being so close to Yakima, it gave me an opportunity to find out more about Patterson as a person. I was more interested in him as a man and a witness to Bigfoot, which he claimed, and a photographer than I was really the film per se, because I feel that the honesty and integrity of a witness, a person who claims to have encountered something unusual, is paramount in judging the veracity of his or her story. So it was very important to look into him as a person, just like the police would do in investigating the character and personality of a potential criminal who they suspect of committing a crime. So I went about it that way. I just went there over the Cascade Mountains back and forth for 4 years, spent a great deal of my time and energy and money on this, and just methodically started interviewing folks. And so a portrait emerged of Roger Patterson that had never been published at all in the Bigfoot field. There was a few little things here and there, but nothing on the scale that it turned out to be for me. I interviewed people on tape. I secured their permission to use their interviews. I looked into criminal archives in Ellensburg, Washington. I dug into the Yakima Herald newspaper for any information. And this picture emerged of a man who simply was dishonest. Dishonest in a pretty significant way. He really was a criminal. Now, I know the Bigfoot believers out there who love this film are going to say, well, it's the film. Who cares about the man who took it? And, you know, I say to you people that, you know, when you look into crimes, and I might suggest you look at Forensic Files or other television shows that deal with detectives and police organizations proving crimes have occurred and who performed them, you'll find always consistently there's something really wrong with the perpetrator of a crime. They have a history of lying. They have a history of fraud in some cases, or stealing, or whatever those things may be. And that's what happened in my investigations. Roger Patterson, I've concluded now, it's been almost 10 years since my book came out, I've given it further thought, was simply a criminal. And not on the scale of a murderer, obviously, but he was a criminal. And my book lays it all out, and, of course, the Bigfoot field has slammed the entire book because they really don't believe that Bigfoot witnesses that their character and their personal history are important to what the claims are. I don't know why the Bigfoot field does this, why they tend to glom onto or be attracted to essentially dishonest people in many respects. And I'm not saying everyone in the Bigfoot field or Bigfoot witnesses are dishonest, but there's a real strong theme that runs through the history of Bigfoot studies, and in which many of these Bigfoot investigators, as they call themselves, tend to gravitate toward and embrace, to put it bluntly, liars. So I could go on for many hours about this, but, you know, I was in thinking of preparing for your show. I thought, what can we talk about? And you have a good question there. But, you know, right now the American people have learned to their regret that the President of the United States lied to them about Obamacare. And I don't want to get into the politics in depth. But, you know, for me personally, I'm one of those people being retired and on a medical insurance plan that it has terrified me about what I've learned could happen to my medical care plan. And he did lie about it. We all know that he did. And, you know, it's you have to face the fact, Bigfoot believers out there, that there are amongst you, unfortunately, Bigfoot believers or proponents or promoters that themselves are either lying or they're terribly sloppy investigators who continue to want to believe the Patterson film, I don't know why. I suppose it promotes themselves personally or the field or whatever. But you need to wake up, guys. You need to face the fact Patterson was a criminal. He lied. He cheated. He stole Rene DeHinden, one of the famous Bigfoot, we'll call him one of the grand men of letters of the Bigfoot field who started the modern era. John Green, one of them, Rene DeHinden. Grover Krantz was another one. Even Rene DeHinden told me in an interview that, you know, that Patterson was a fraud.
And, yet, I'm hold on. Let me just calm you just a second.
Okay.
And I love you, man.
I'm obviously have very strong feelings about Roger Patterson.
I champion behind what you are and what you've done. All I want you to do is give them a little tidbit. Give him a few bullet points. You know, he's a crook. He's a thief. He's a criminal. But why? Note some of the things that you have in your book that they can go and get and see. What are some of those things?
Well, one of the primary witnesses that I found, which absolutely no one in the Bigfoot field has even commented on, was what he did to Vilma Radford. Vilma Radford was helped operate with her husband an upholstery shop. Basically, they upholstered cars, okay? And Patterson found out that she had been in an accident and had received a settlement because of the accident. The driver who was culpable injured her very severely. She was in the hospital. He found out she had a settlement, and he targeted her specifically, went to her business, and managed to persuade her to invest in his film project. He said, "I'm going to film Bigfoot." She loaned him $700, and there was interest due on it. And he took the money, and several months later, he filmed the Bigfoot in California. He never, ever paid her back what he loaned her. The money was there. We know that Al Diatley, for example, has stated that he made, along with Patterson, at least $200,000 from promoting the film in the West and the Midwest in theaters, and yet Patterson absolutely refused to pay her back. To me, you know, you can say, well, that's not really being criminal. Well, he lied about it, okay? He lied about it. He refused to pay her. Okay, that was one instance. Another one, he had
a signed agreement. Is that correct?
Signed an agreement. She had some witnesses there come over and so on and so forth. So he knew the agreement existed. Then she went out to his house finally when she found out that the film had been made and he was making money from it and said, "I want my money." He said, "There is no money." A lie. Okay, so he lied. In another instance, he cheated book publishers who published his book, Do Abominable Snowmen of America Really Exist? There were two publishers noted in my book, or, you know, print shop owners. He had them printed. He refused to pay for the printing. They would attempt to get a hold of him, but he had no phone number, which they believed was purposeful so he wouldn't have to hear from his creditors. But he never paid them for it. Those are two glaring and obvious instances where he cheated people. Rene DeHinden told me in an interview that Patterson, once his book was published, would receive orders for it from people in the public, and in some cases, he just kept their checks and never sent them the book. Okay.
What happened about the camera company, the film place where he went and rent the
now he rented the camera that he took down to Northern California, and he never returned it. The shop owner attempted to find Patterson to demand that he return the camera. He could never get Patterson to do so. So he took it to the law, and the Yakima County Sheriff went out and arrested Patterson. Because Patterson simply refused to return the camera. Why is that? Why is this? Why wouldn't this man not simply return the camera that he rented? His behavior was reprehensible, and you know, the line out there, of course, is, "Well, you got to forget about the guy." You know, Larry Lund stated in my book, I interviewed him, that it could have been Adolf Hitler who would have taken the film It doesn't really matter. Well, Adolf Hitler was a racist and a liar and a mass murderer. Okay, I don't respect Adolf Hitler. And so the question of honesty and integrity is really important. But I'm getting a little emotional about it because I'm very tired of still observing out in the Bigfoot field that there's people who simply won't give up this lie. They're damaging their own field. They're damaging their reputation. They're coming across as very sloppy investigators. They don't use science. They don't use the tools that any good detective or any good investigator would use. They simply refuse to do it with the film.
You know, you just said a key word here, science. You know, there were several scientists that attested to the authenticity of the PG film, and several of them did not. Most scientists have judged the film a hoax. I don't know if you know about that.
That's true. I can't quote their names, but it's available in the literature. I'm sure you can find that.
Elder. He was the head of the Department of Mammals, and Dr. Shapiro, the Department of Anthropology, just to name a few. But here's my big problem and my big worry, Greg. What do you say to the scientific world today that has attached themselves to this film and said that, oh, it's real, and these people are teaching our kids?
Well, I what do you say to so-called educators who should be teaching objective fact? You know, I guess you have to look at it in the context of our educational system today. For me, it's a very sorry state where facts really aren't encouraged as more as sort of affective or emotional-based teaching. History is not important. The facts of the history of your country aren't important. And that's partially a political problem. I guess you just have to say to educators that you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You know, doctors take Hippocratic oaths to do everything to treat their patients and save their lives. Educators ought to have one that's similar, that I'm in the profession not to pollute or ruin or twist my students' minds and to teach them loose thinking and sloppy thinking and non-critical judgment. All we can do is say, shame on you. You know, we know there is one professor that lives in Idaho. Why mention his name? But it's a sad state of affairs. You know, I'm not going to go into him, but I don't know. I think it's dangerous for this film to continue to be promoted. I think it's high time there be further exposure about what the hoax was all about and who's involved in it. And, you know, Tom and I have talked in this, and I think it's not time to tell your audience this, but I think we're on to some approaches that may finally blow this completely out of the water. People still want to deny the reality because there's no Bigfoot suit. How do you know? Hieronymus is a liar. But there are people who know, and I think it's high time that we have them, you know, fully confess.
Without a doubt. Here's another question. I'm just looking at some of the stuff that the emails are coming into me right now. And they says, what role did DeHinden have in this matter? And we all understand that he owns at least 50% of the film along with Patricia Patterson. How'd that come about? Do you happen to know?
Well, if I recall, and I do have some of that information in my book, you know, DeHinden was a Bigfoot hunter that actually never really went out in the field, as far as I understand it. I read this, not just my own understanding, but I read this in several different places. You know, he was one of the first people in Canada to begin to promote, along with Green, to promote Bigfoot. Of course, at that time, it was called more popularly Sasquatch. We still hear of Sasquatch today, but it was essentially Sasquatch. You know, he was looking for the creature. He put, you know, and here's his upstart, Roger Patterson, actually took a film. And I think that he saw, when the money began to pour in for Patterson, I think he saw that there could be money for himself. And in fact, Green and DeHinden bought a copy of the film from Al Diatley, Roger Patterson's brother-in-law, not long after it was taken for their own purposes. And so DeHinden did say that he really he looked into – he told me he knew that Patterson was a fraud and a crook, okay, But he said, well, you know, the film, you can't, you know, the film doesn't lie, et cetera. We know all the arguments, the height of the creature, the length of the arms, the way it strides, and that sort of thing. And he did go down to the film site, looked into that. He did a lot of his own investigations, and he sought out originally to try to disprove it, which I think is pretty important here, because he really did not believe it. I want to disprove it. In the end, he accepted the film, but he also accepted Patterson as a con artist. But really, it was money. He saw money. And Gimlin was being mistreated by D'Attley and Patterson. This is all in my book. Because Gimlin would not go out on the road with D'Attley and Patterson in the winter of 68 to 69 to present the film to audiences and theaters in the West and the Midwest. Gimlin would not do that. Gimlin, interestingly, shied away from it, which I find really curious. He did that the day that the film was shown in D'Attley's house, by the way. Gimlin didn't show up to look at it. But anyway, Gimlin was being mistreated by D'Attley and so on. But Gimlin apparently claimed that he had a part of the business that was promoting it called Bigfoot Enterprises. And what he really did is he sold out his interest to René de Hinden for $10, for a mere $10. And that gave de Hinden a position to be able to gain more rights to the film. And he did manage to secure the still pictures from the film itself. It's a convoluted story. It's in my book, but it was really money. De Hinden wanted to make money out of it. That's what I've concluded.
Mm-hmm. And then I understand also that anybody that had anything to do with the film or so-called invested or gave him or lent him money, and they came back to him, apparently, was it De Hinden that paid them all off and bought their shares?
Well, he did do that. He took care of loose ends, I guess you might put it that way, because anyone who had a claim to part of the film, he had to buy off their share of that claim, their rights. I don't know who else he might have bought off to do that, who had a claim in it. D'Attley basically washed his hands of it after he made his money from it. And so the rights really reverted to Patty Patterson and René de Hinden.
Correct. Now, I don't know if it was you or some other investigative reporter was telling me that Al D'Attley actually came right out and told one of you guys straight out, my brother-in-law is nothing but a crook and a liar.
Well, D'Attley basically told me that, that his brother-in-law was a crook and a liar. In fact, I had a quote of that in my book, and I've got my book in front of me. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to find it fast enough for your audience. But D'Attley gave me a very detailed picture of Roger Patterson. And, you know, basically he did say that he was kind of a straight person. I guess we might call him a bum, because he wouldn't work for a living. And so Patterson being married to Patterson's youngest sister was married and is married to Al D'Attley. So D'Attley's wife, a Patterson, very much wants to protect Roger Patterson himself because Patterson did not have any money. He didn't want to work for a living and so on. So Patterson came to D'Attley and would bump money off him, basically. I need some bucks. I need some money. And D'Attley essentially said in my interview with him that he didn't believe the film was a hoax, although he's never come out more definitively to tell me that, which is an issue I have with him. But Patterson didn't work for a living. He simply refused to do so. So he was helped by either Patty Patterson's father, Amandor, or helped by Al D'Attley, you know, on and off, or Patterson would make money in whatever way he could, you know, his book. He tried to gin up some money from his book, but he was chronically unemployed, and so that's the reason why he would not pay his bills. He wouldn't pay the printers. He wouldn't pay Vilmer Radford. He kept his phone off the hook. One of the collection agencies came to Vilmer Radford's house looking for Roger Patterson, because the collection agency had learned that Radford had an arrangement with Patterson, and this collection agent basically said, I have a 3-inch notebook filled with bills that Patterson has not paid. So Patterson just simply didn't pay his bills, and he just bummed things off people.
Now here's another question that I'm looking on the screen right now. Tom, is there more than one Patterson film, and has the original been edited, and which one has most of the people seen today? Can you answer that question?
Well, I don't have all the detailed information about the film. Ray Crow might be able to help you more. Our biggest problem is we don't have the original film. If you don't have the original film, how do you know that copies of the film reflect the same content as the original film?
Great question. Let me put you on hold there just for a second, please, Greg. Ray, are you on?
I'm still here, yeah.
Can you answer that question?
I was looking for my notes on it, too, at the same time. But, yeah, Mrs. Patterson gave 8 different slides to M.K. Davis, for instance, and he noticed that they were different. They'd been changed from what the original was. So there's been some editing on the film somewhere by somebody.
There has been, hasn't there? Okay, at this point in time, I think it's time that we bring in Leroy Blevins. Leroy, are you out there?
Well, while you're waiting for him, I'll mention that Harry Kimball, back in 96, gave a signed statement saying that he was present in the editing room when Roger Patterson and all of them put together the 16mm film of the man in the gorilla costume.
Wait a minute. Go say that slowly and louder.
Oh, Harry Kimball, 1996, signed statement. He was present in the editing room when Roger Patterson et al. Put together the 16mm film of the man in the gorilla costume.
Wow. Were you aware of that, Greg?
The name Kimball, I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that.
I believe I
wasn't able to find him, so I don't know what else to say.
Okay.
Sloppiness on how the original was handled and subsequent copies were made.
Okay, let me find out. Leroy?
Yes.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Okay.
And thank you for the work that you've done. Have you found through your investigative legal beagle that you are when it comes to the film stuff, how many films were made, actually, of this thing? Was the original, and did they edit it? What's the story?
Okay, there was the original film, and then there was about 3 other films that they actually filmed, too. And they did edit it in 1968 by Ron Olson in A&E.
Okay.
That's why at the end of the film that we see today is a remade film, because if you watch the very end of the film, right on the very end of the reel, you'll see the date is 11-7-68, and that's written in Ron Olson's one written on it. Because the name of the film is called American Bigfoot. Okay?
All right.
And then no one owns the rights to that film.
No one owns the right to that film?
No. The original film was called Bluff Creek Bigfoot, 1967, and in Library of Congress, the rights to that film is to Robert E. Gimlin and Mrs. Roger Patterson.
Uh-huh, that makes sense.
Yeah, you bet. So anything on the side was a private agreement between the Hendon family and Patterson family. Now, my question to you, Leroy, is this. Have you been listening since the beginning of the show?
Yes.
And you heard about the email I received from the guy named Richie?
Mm-hmm.
You saw that email because I sent it to you. Is that correct?
Yes.
When you went into that footage, did you see the same thing that he saw?
Yes, that was Bob Gimlin behind the brush.
You know, here's that name, you know, and forgive me, Greg Long. You know, you tell me that he didn't go to the meeting. you know, at the, in the basement of Al DiAtle, the man that supposedly was the financier of all this thing, or most of it anyway.
Right.
And Gimlin said, no, I don't want to go, or didn't show up. And then, you know, I tried to interview him, and he wouldn't talk to me at all because he knows that I knew Roger, even though it was very briefly. But it was during his illness through another associate of mine back then in, you know, 69, 70. I guess he passed in 71, wasn't it?
72.
January, February of 72. It was winter, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
January 15th.
Okay, yeah, January, yeah. So my point is this, okay? The timeline we have figured, ladies and gentlemen, is way off kilter. Okay, it is not. This film was not taken in October of 67. What have you come up with on the timeline on this, Leroy?
It was filmed during Labor Day weekend of 1967.
You know, Tom, can I break in a couple seconds?
Of course.
I need to explain something to the viewers and everybody. If you go up on www.bigfootlive.com, that's our radio page, and if you look at the table of contents on the left side, on the very bottom, you'll see Patterson Gimlin Deception, and that's a page. And a lot of Leroy's pictures that we're talking about right now are there. Leroy will step us through those later in the show, but you need to have Internet Explorer as your browser. It does not work with a couple of the other browsers, and it's just because of the inconsistency of HTML at the time here that we have.
Okay, so while we have Leroy on, Leroy, why don't you describe to our listeners around the globe what you've got up there?
Okay, well, I've got a bunch of pictures actually on there.
Well, let's stay focused on the topic that we're talking about right now. The guy Richie called or emailed me and stated, a minute, so many seconds into the film, you see a man pop in and pop out?
Yes, okay, that's Bob Gimlin.
Okay, that was Bob Gimlin. Mm-hmm. So this apparently had to be of the original film. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, because apparently on the later versions, that has been edited out. Is that correct?
No, actually still in the film. The only one they edited out was, which I showed Marco Bill today, frames of John Green.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me John Green was in the film also?
He was.
Forgive me, ladies and gentlemen, but it just verifies what I thought all along. Mr. Ray Crow, did you hear that?
I heard that, yes. I'm jotting it down now.
Mr. Greg Long, did you hear that?
Well, yeah, I've heard that, and I really don't know how to comment on that. One of my problems that I've told you before in some conversations, Tom, is that the Rorschach approach to reading things into shadows and tree branches and leaves and tree trunks and light and so on, I just have a little bit of a problem with finding images of people or things that aren't out in the clearing in the bright light of the day.
I know.
That's my comment. I'm not saying that to go back to Leroy's image. I've looked at the image. I'll be damned. It does look like Bob Gimlin's face.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to comment on John Green. I'm sure he would deny that.
I'm sure he would too. so let's try to get a little bit. A better clarification, if we can, Leroy.
Yeah, more specific.
Yeah, a little bit more
Green.
Specific.
All right, well, I noticed there was an image that they blurred out in each one of the frames. There was like 13 frames where it was an image blurred out. You could see walking across the front of the camera and bends down out of frame. So what I did was a lot of researchers claimed, well, this is the S-tree. When Roger Patterson was moving around this S-tree, that's where you get that blurry image. But even in the clear images, in the clear frames, where you can see all the details in the trees and everything else in the ground, you still see this blurry image. So what I did was I overlaid an image of that S tree to line it up over the blurry spot, and it wouldn't line up whatsoever. So I said, well, this person is walking in this, like, S-shaped style walking. So I went back to the tracking dog film, and as I was watching that, we see John Green walking in it, and he walks in this S-shaped style form. So what I did was I took him and overlaid him over the blurry images in each one of the frames, and his profile lines up perfectly right in each one of the frames of that blurry image.
Wow.
Well, that's interesting. It's probably for the audience, it's fairly complex, and it'd have to be shown step by step by step.
Well, see,
but you did.
People don't know is when I was analyzing the film, people's looking at the PG film, but actually was three films filmed during that time. There was
this is what I think is very fascinating and would be very constructive, is to put into a presentation in a logical step-by-step fashion each of the films, where they came from if known, when they were shot if known, and that sort of thing, show the differences and similarities between them, which should help fall out the pieces that were edited out or edited in, and essentially draw a conclusion that one or all of them were in some way doctored or edited together. it is complex, and I, my focus has been on the man, Patterson, and I'm certainly not, doubting anyone's work in analyzing the film. But I think that's what's going to be needed to explain to the public that this film was doctored and edited, and as a result of not having the original, we have, a problem with that, but within the copies themselves, we can show they've been tampered with, which tells me somebody wanted to fake the public.
You bet. And it stems back to the time that Wilmer Radner was approached by Mr. Patterson. And Mr.
Radford, yeah.
I'm going out there to film this Bigfoot movie.
Yeah, he made it, the context of the fact that he didn't have enough money, had to beg and steal to get it, and from her he took it. I have done a little bit of a timeline as well on the processing of the film, when it would have left, this sort of ties in with what Ray was talking about, when it would have left Eureka, or Arcata, and gotten to Aldi Atlee, who says he did process it, but he doesn't know where. And we have like about a 48-hour timeline from the moment that Patterson took it to that it was shipped out of Northern California, processed, delivered to D'Atlee, and then shown at his home. And Ray's done a good job showing that the amount of time for all these activities would have prevented Patterson from shipping it from a post office. And, of course, Peter Byrne has done some work as well looking into pilots who could have flown it out of Northern California. At the time there were storms, none of them flew it out or could have even flown it out. So all these little bits and pieces are pointing to the fact that the film was likely shot before the 20th, and so I agree with Blevins. It could have been very well on Labor Day.
And you know what? We did it in our movie also. We've got verification and timelines from a bush pilot from Canada, and we've got his log, his flight log, okay, and it tells the actual date and shows it. It's in our film, Hoax of the Century.
Oh, okay. I've forgotten that we have that. But to help your audience out is because we're talking about a lot of different people and activities and so on, the main point to make is that this film was very likely shot before the 20th of October when Patterson said it was, which means he lied, okay? And having a longer time frame to shoot it allowed more time to get it processed, okay? Because processing that film in 19, 67 would have taken a special shipment of the film to Palo Alto, California, and it just could not have been turned around in 48 hours, the way that Patterson said so.
That's right. When did they all meet in D'Attley's basement to view it?
That was on the 22nd.
Okay, now let's...
Sunday, so it was shot on a Friday, supposedly, on the 20th.
Okay, now I gotta add my two cents if I can, please, Greg. And
sure.
I'll tell you the reason why. I was with a guy named Ivan Marks, and he did a lot of wildlife footage, and he did it with old Bolex 16mm, the old crank camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, I was with him on a lot of excursions. And a lot of times, he would take that film, and he would send it also to Palo Alto, California, to Kodak on Page Mill Road. I'll never forget it. And he used to tell me, you know, as quick as I want it back, Tom, he says, I normally, it takes around 7 days between the time they get it and they do it all, and then they send it back to me. He says, within 10 days, I normally get it back, and that's with a rush.
Right, and I found that from interviewing lab processors in Seattle, of which some of them copied the film for Patterson, especially before he went up to Canada shortly after the shoot and presented it to these Canadian scientists. They all said it took a long time. It took 5 to 7 days. So I think Leroy's statement that this was shot early on Labor Day, and the fact also you have to remember is that Green and DeHinden were down there as well.
Oh.
In that time frame. It just tells me that you take Patterson's character, and then you take these bits of pieces, which are now data that I think could stand in a court of law, that this film was taken earlier than it was, Patterson told the world, and there was plenty of time to process it and also edit it as they wanted to, which is where Leroy's work falls into place. And, of course, Ray, we have to add, of course, what Ray has found here with the overall timeline. So it's very impressive. It's hard to get this information drilled into the heads of a lot of Bigfoot believers, and it's probably confusing for new members of the Bigfoot field, but I would urge them to read my book, start there, get up to speed on Leroy's work. And, you know, Ray, I believe, is going to be publishing a book that covers the this hoax in more detail.
Yes, he is. Well,
that'll be a Bigfoot behavior.
Right?
And, matter of fact, Pine Winds Press is going to publish it, and it should be out in late spring or in the middle summer.
You cover this section, this chapter, pretty heavy.
Behavior.
Ray?
What'd you say, Tom?
Are you going to be covering this chapter on the Gimlin film pretty heavy?
Oh, I have a whole chapter on it, yes. And I have oodles and oodles of other little tidbits that I put together that all of them come up to be damning information, to the point where you could probably convict him in a court without a body.
Oh, gee.
Well, that's exciting, Rand. I'm glad you're doing it.
It is.
You know, especially at your age, you're like me, you're getting along in years. I'm 67 now, and I've been, you know, since I started this in 98, I guess I've been at this a long time. But, you know, a lot of criminal cases, it does take a lot of laborious work. If you watch some of these TV shows, some of these cases aren't solved until 10 or 15 or 20 years later. It just takes hard work.
It does. And you know what? I got to tell you something. Leroy, I give you a ton of kudos for... You know, it's been a thankless job what you've done in a lot of cases, and you've been ridiculed a ton, I'm sure. And I want to thank you for what you've done. And I don't know, how many hours you got wrapped up in this now?
9 years.
9 years, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
9 years. And I'll tell you what, you've become a fountain of information when it comes to this film. What do people say to you, Leroy? People in the Bigfoot industry.
Well, a lot of them actually start now, after seeing more of my research, they're actually understanding it a lot more now, because I show, like I said, when I analyze the film, I've been analyzing films photos for over 20 years. And why I say there was three films shot there is because the tracking dog film, the PG film, and the film of Jim McLaren walking the path of Bigfoot, and the frames, they have glitches in it. And each one of these frames has the same glitches.
And what was in that glitch?
Well, it indicates that it was all filmed with the same camera.
I see. Okay. So there's some artifacts in the film images such that suggest it's a mechanical effect on the film.
Yeah, well, see, just like the, when I was analyzing the Jim McLaren film, they said it was filmed in 1968. Well, when I was analyzing the PG film, I would see bark hanging on trees and stuff in Jim McLaren's film, but they're not in the PG film.
Here we go, another season, one more time.
Yeah,
you know, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I'm going to make an announcement right now, loud and clear. All the people in the Bigfoot world, listen very closely. I'm working together with some of the greatest minds in the industry when it comes to infiltrating bullshit. This happens to be bullshit. And we've gotten some leads lately due to the fact of the movie being out, Hoax of the Century, and The Making of Bigfoot, the book. And people have come forward. And we're collaborating, three of us, the four of us who are here tonight, with our information. And we may be blowing the lid on one of the biggest hoaxes ever. And you know what? We're going to make sure that it's the right people, the right timeline. And when we do, you'll all hear about it because it'll be an international press conference and all those people will be there. And you know what? It'll be a sad day in the Bigfoot world because once and for all, we're going to put the PG film to rest. I want to thank Ray Crow. You're a great friend from over a ton of years. My newfound friend.
I don't know how many now.
Yeah, it's been a long time, Ray. And for my newfound friend, and he's like family to me now, Greg Long, wonderful guy. And what can I say about you, Leroy, but you've been with me for many, many years, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. This has been a very informative show, ladies and gentlemen. It's not the end. This is just the beginning. Kudos and salutations. Till next time, America.
Well, folks, once again, it's time to say so long. We'd like to thank Mr. Tom Biscardi and his guests and the Bigfoot team for joining us, and we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. This is Marco Bill saying see you next Wednesday evening for some more Bigfoot Live radio show entertainment with Mr. Tom Biscardi and his team. And until then, keep the Bigfoot live and keep Bigfooting. See you next week.
Three men with a gold and a pack that they'd hold and a promise till the day that they die. Answers to the questions no one's found before. Driving determination, the only key they had to unlock the door. Monsters, myths, and mysteries, legend, tales, and facts.